This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Welcome everybody to Cinematic Animalia, the podcast where we look at movie monsters, creatures, parasites, where we kick like a Spartan and hate George R. R. Martin, because I really detest him. Anyway, today we are looking at the dragons from Game of Thrones. First time back with a big franchise in a while.
Yeah.
We've been doing independent horror flicks. Which is all well and good, but I'm looking forward to getting back to the classics. In any case, before we get into that, my name is Sam Perrin. I am a PhD student at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, and I run ecologyforthemasses.com. With me today, in spirit, is co-host number one, Adam Harshik, who will be chiming in with a few well-placed comments. However, he is absent. Out in the field after his PhD candidacy exam, which he has passed, I believe. With me also is co-host number two, Dave from Canada. Now, like I said, today we're looking at the physiology of the Game of Thrones dragons. We looked at some less classic dragons, the guys from How to Train Your Dragon, Toothless, and those of his ilk earlier in the season. I highly recommend going back and checking that out, because that was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, but today we are focusing on what I would consider more classic dragons. But no, we had a really interesting week. So, obviously, in less happy news, the Notre Dame Cathedral burnt down recently.
Yeah.
Which prompted a series of tweets by various ecologists saying, oh, well, who cares? What about all these species that are going extinct? Shut up. People are allowed to be sad about a cultural icon as well as about environmental causes as well. That's my message.
I do understand some people getting mad about the fact that billionaires have donated huge amounts of wealth to the church, which already has tons of money to take care of repairs associated with Notre Dame. I do understand where people are coming forward and they're like, this feels kind of shitty that you guys will give to this, but you won't give to child care or to maternal care or to healthcare.
But that's the thing. It's just, this is a lot more public and visible as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
People have compared it. So I had a really good dialogue with a guy called Jeremy Fox from Dynamic Ecology. Yeah, he's a very famous ecologist, one of the largest bloggers in the world. So I was very honoured that, you know, he commented on our post and all that sort of stuff. We got a lot of visibility.
Cool.
It was fantastic. And we were talking about how there were some people out there who compared this to, you know, us saying, hey, shut up and let these people, you know, think about the cultural icon. And people who were saying, you know, that's like gun violence happening and saying, let's not talk about this now, let's wait about it. No, I don't think that's what this is. I don't think that's an appropriate analogy. I think this is the same as gun violence happening and somebody saying, oh, well, who cares about gun violence because we're killing all these species all the time.
Right.
It's a completely different issue. And I don't think we should shame people for you know, being sad about Notre Dame.
No, and for missing that absolutely something so beautiful and gorgeous has been destroyed. Although I'm really happy the bees survived. I think that was my happiest part of all of this.
The bees survived, yeah. There was a lot of shock online because somebody was like, yeah, well, bees don't have lungs. And people were just like, what? Bees don't have what? It's like, yeah, bees don't... not everything has lungs.
There's spiracles, yeah.
Yeah, there's fucking vertebrates. Like, there's lots of salamanders that don't have lungs. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, don't worry about it. It's okay. We've got the salamanders have things under control. They have for fucking millions of years. Anyway, moving on, we are going to switch over to Adam, who's actually read the books, and knows a lot more about Game of Thrones than either of us.
Us.
To tell you a little bit about the about like kind of the background, what you need to know about the Game of Thrones dragons. So yeah, take us away, Adam.
So for the dragons in A Game of Thrones, or as the books are called, A Song of Ice and Fire, the first one's called A Game of Thrones, they are originally from a place called Valyria, which is a country slash nation state slash empire that was, I want to say, to the north of, it was north of Essos, a little bit northeast of where Westeros is. And that is where all the Targaryens come from. All the people there, at least the ruling class, because it was very much a slave society, had that silvery, gold, platinum hair that all the Targaryens are supposed to have, with those purple eyes. And the Targaryens were originally, like, just, they were actually a lesser house. They weren't even the big dogs in Valyria.
Okay.
But one of the members of that line had like prophetic dreams, which happens sometimes with the Targaryens. And so they set up a citadel at Dragonstone, which is over there, that little island on the side of, on the east side of Westeros, where the Targaryens have their castle.
Okay,
and
right.
So they brought over their
family. I've actually been to the place that that's based on in real life. Really fucking cool.
Dragonstone?
No, I mean, not Dragonstone. The place where they filmed Dragonstone, like that kind of sloping monastery. Yeah, I've been to there. It's fucking amazing. It's in the Basque country in Spain.
Oh, wow. That's gorgeous.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Sick. Yeah, so the Targaryens, they moved all of their wealth, all of their possessions, and their dragons over to Westeros. And then in Valyria, where all the other dragons were, all the other dragon riders, the doom happened. So basically, Valyria was built around what was called the 14 Flames, these 14 massive volcanoes, and they all, boom, they went supernova, kind of like the Yellowstone caldera is predicted to in the next 50,000 years or so.
Okay.
So all the dragons, all the dragon riders, all that society is gone. Okay. All that was left was the dragons that the Targaryens brought over to Westeros. So they're not native to Westeros at all.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
They apparently, from what I'm getting from the books at least, there really aren't sexed that often. That we know Drogon, Dany's main dragon, is referred to as a he often. In the book, she also calls Viserion and Rhaegal he's. But all of the other dragons that you read about in the history of Westeros, of the Targaryen dynasty, with the exception of one, are never sexed.
Okay.
And that one being Balerion, the Black Dread, the biggest dragon that ever lived.
Okay.
That was the one that Aegon the Conqueror rode, and it was hundreds of years old. It was the size of a 747, enormous, swallowing Orcs in one go.
Okay.
And it was, those dragons were the reason the Targaryens were able to take over all of Westeros.
Okay.
They didn't have that many men, they didn't have that many soldiers, but they had three massive, indestructible, fire-breathing dragons.
Okay. Cool.
So at least it looks like that these dragons are, they're not native to Westeros, they don't seem to have, they must have some kind of sex, but that's not really brought up that often. And one thing that seems to be happening is that they are parthenogenic, so that they can, the females at least, can have clonal reproduction. They just lay eggs that aren't fertilized, but they're just giving birth to more females that also have the same ability, much like Komodo dragons do sometimes.
Okay. And then in the show, our first introduction to them is the very end of the first season, I think it was, where you have Daenerys being given these dragon eggs in like the second or third episode. She goes nuts, sets her tent on fire with herself inside it. There's some ritual to it, I can't remember. It was a long time ago, the first season of Game of Thrones.
So what happened was, as a wedding gift, Ilario Mopatis, the merchant who set her up with set her brother up with to marry her to Khal Drogo. He gave her these three dragon eggs as a gift, and to him they were just hunks of rock. To everyone they were hunks of rock, because there were many dragon eggs that were laid during the time of the Targaryens, when they still had dragons, before they had their big civil war that killed off most of their dragons. And so eggs were given to every Targaryen child. Some of them were taken, some of them were stolen, some were sold. And so there are a handful of dragon eggs out in the world somewhere. And these three happened to make it to Essos, to Ilario, who gave them to Dany, thinking they were nothing but rocks and they were just kind of pretty.
Okay.
Dany had a sense that they needed to be hot. She always kept them on like a brazier of coals. And then what she did, she thought it was something with magic, kind of needing a life for a life. So one life was Khal Drogo, and she burned him alive on the funeral pyre. Well, after she killed him, she strangled him with a pillow. She burned him on the funeral pyre.
Yeah.
She lost her unborn son. That was another life. And then she burnt the witch, Miri Mazdur, who killed her son.
Okay.
Who fucked up Khal Drogo. So those three lives were, quote-unquote, sacrificed for the dragons. And then she walked into the fire with these eggs that were, you could hear them cracking in this massive, massive hot funeral pyre.
Okay.
And they were all born. And she was unburned.
Yeah. Yeah, and they've grown, and we'll talk about this today. They've grown substantially throughout the seasons, like almost just consistently.
Enormously.
Yeah, they're huge, which we'll get into, which Dave will get into today, because they're just way too big. But anyway.
Yeah, not enough.
They breathe fire very much in the traditional kind of, you know, nothing like Toothless in How to Train Your Dragon. Very much, they're as traditional dragons as you're going to get, really.
Yep, continual stream of fire, no projectile balls of flame or anything like that.
Yeah. But yeah, okay, so obviously I love the TV series. I think it's fantastic. Adam, you're a big fan of the books, I know.
I'm a huge fan of the books. Yeah. I like the TV series quite a bit. I have quite a few issues with some things they do. The main one being making one of the only gay character, one of the only mainly gay characters in the book, a flouncing sissy boy in the show when he's still so Renly. The king's brother.
You told me about this before. Yeah.
Yep. In the books, he's supposed to be just like Robert. He's a big, strapping, manly man who is, for the people of that time at least, a little bit effeminate, but he's not nearly as ridiculous as he is on the show, and it's not as obvious. Not everyone knows. People talk about it, they joke about it, but he's still, he's a ladies' man, everyone loves him, he's super charming, he's super handsome, he's a big, muscular dude.
Yeah.
And not this little guy who's afraid of blood.
Yes, okay, fair enough, yeah. All right, well, yeah.
And at least in the books, they can be dark, but the show kind of takes some licenses with some unnecessary rape, which doesn't happen in the books, and I don't know why they do it.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Adam. So, that's what, you know. Adam's given you an overview of the dragons. Just an overview of what he likes about Game of Thrones as well, does and doesn't like. Dave and I are kind of, we're both fans of the show.
Oh, it's a great show. Fantastically well written, really, really interesting, and just 100% deserving of the culture icon status that it carries around.
Yeah, I think so too. I it got really slow for me from seasons maybe 4 to 6. A little too much wheeling and dealing, dealing and wheeling, depending on, you know, your etymological status. But I think it's fantastic. I have to say, before we get into this today, we're looking at the dragons. We're specifically looking at, you know, the physiology and ecology of this world. However, I was sent by my colleague Lara Vailet, who actually has helped out, helped me with some theories and concepts, fleshing out ideas on the show a bunch of times. This fantastic YouTube video on the anthropology of the Game of Thrones, looking at the evolution of the hominid species that you see. So, and that actually really helped me. Get a lot of ideas and taught me a lot about, like, the continent structure of Game of Thrones as well. So I have to shout that out. It's by Trey the Explainer. If you type in the anthropology of Game of Thrones, really good video. I highly recommend checking that out.
These are not quite accurate for my dragons. These are not my dragons, because my dragons only have 2 legs. Other dragons by fantasy writers have 4 legs and wings. I just have 2 legs and wings.
Why?
Because it's more scientifically accurate.
But we are not anthropologists, though I am living with one. We are physiologists and ecologists. So, Dave, starting out today, do you want to take us through the physiology of the dragons at Game of Thrones?
Yeah, so, I mean, like we've been trying to do lately, I think there are tons of topics to start talking about with the dragons, but I'm going to try to focus on 3 key areas that are kind of cool. And potentially sort of brushing over one that I'll talk about a little bit more with Sam, but we're probably not going to go into a huge detail because we've discussed it in pretty great detail before. But the first big thing that I want to talk about is the dragons, which are fantastic. They're my favorite part of the show. I'm not going to lie. I actually, spoiler alert for anyone that's watching.
Oh, yeah, big spoilers for this, yeah.
Yeah. I stopped watching at the death of the first dragon for a little while. It took me a while to, like, get back into the show, because honestly, when one of the dragons died, I was like, fuck it, this is why I was watching the show. I don't need to see less dragon. And I did get back into it, but I really love specifically Drago. Now, in terms of the breathing fire, which is the first thing that I really want to talk about with the dragons, because it's the coolest thing. And also, I think it's a mechanism that I can separate from the breathing fire that we've discussed previously with our How to Train Your Dragons episode.
Yeah.
So,
the dragons... did focus mainly on Toothless and his kind of explosive mechanism there.
Yeah, and the methane dragons, the ones that could spread the sort of fume and the gas that was ignited.
Yes.
So, in terms of the Game of Thrones dragon, it's a much more typical spewing a constant stream of fire, like a flamethrower or a napalm.
Yep.
Now, this is really hard to do in nature, and I did go through a number of different blog posts by various physiologists and biologists trying to come up with an idea of like how this would work, or is there a natural mechanism that we can make that would potentially get this to work? And I think I'm going to have to make a couple of concessions to shift this, but at the end of the episode, I would briefly like to talk about a physicist had written a little piece on Game of Thrones, and I'll be creating a link and attaching it to the website. But he comes up with a really cool theory of how the dragons would fly, breathe fire, and why everybody in Westeros is super violent.
Oh, I've read that. That is very interesting. That's the atmosphere density thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's also interesting. We can get into that later. I've got...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to try to build our dragons like this because we like to build our dragons like they would work on Earth and in the real world.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to try to make any big alterations other than trying to shift their physiology. So...
Yes.
The first concept that I kind of played around with was the idea that it could, and some people have suggested this before, have a dragon similar to a cobra, basically spitting out two different chemicals that when they spontaneously react in the air, generate this flame that creates this constant flame existing in front of the dragon. Mm-hmm. This is possible. There are a couple different types of spitting cobras that do have the ability to spit venom at various people and can have multiple gland sets that are associated with the mouth that could theoretically create something like this. However, you gotta be really careful with your combining different chemicals, how close they're getting to your face, and whether or not they start to back up into the affected glands. Because one of the things that a lot of people have talked about is if you're spitting out two chemicals that are mixing together, one, they're going to ignite that not that far from directly in front of your face, which is not great. Lots of different species have various forms of heat resistance, but nothing is fireproof. Fire is generally bad all around.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of people reference the like, oh, well, Frankenstein is afraid of fire, or, you know, the Martian.
Frankenstein's monster, I think you mean.
Yes, Frankenstein's monster. Or,
sorry, I hate people who fucking do that shit.
The Martian
Manhunter. We all know what you're talking about. If somebody says Frankenstein, everybody knows you mean the monster, okay? Shut up. That's directed not at you, Dave, but at just everyone in general.
The Martian Manhunter in the comics is afraid of fire, and Robot Chicken did a good part where they're like, yeah, it's fire. Everything's afraid of fire.
Yeah.
So, generally speaking, I don't think this is going to be your best idea, as well as you can get blowback that if you're spitting out this constant bit of fire into any form of breeze or wind or anything like that, as these chemicals are igniting, there's a good chance they're going to blow back into your face, and there's a chance that the mixing of the chemicals is going to back up into the glands that are responsible and potentially ignite inside of the body.
And your head explodes.
Yeah, not ideal.
Yeah.
Not fantastic. The second method I played with was the same idea that we talked about in a previous episode, the idea of trying to create some sort of flammable gas that you would expel and then ignite outside of the body. Mm-hmm. But as we discussed in the How to Train Your Dragons episode, not a great system, generally speaking, to try and have a gas. Gases tend to dissipate really, really quickly. They're hard to control. And again, you're fighting with the same idea that any form of breeze or stream or anything like that, especially because you're a dragon and you are flying through the air at high speeds trying to spew fire, is going to be a really bad idea if it backs up into your face. You're going to take out your eyes. You're going to get severe burns. So... The last system that I sort of ended up coming out with, and I think I'm actually much more comfortable with it, is the idea that they're going to use something called pyrophoric chemicals. So, pyrophoric chemicals are chemicals that spontaneously ignite when exposed to oxygen. The best examples in nature are white phosphorus, that I'm not going to use here, or the much better example, which is iron sulfide. And basically the idea being that it's a chemical that if flung out, when exposed to oxygen, it has an incredibly violent reaction and bursts into flames. Now, when we store white phosphorus in a lab setting, we actually coat it in an oil. And you have to be really careful because when it's coated in an oil and it's in a jar, it's totally inert. But if you take it out of the jar and you scrape the oil off of the white phosphorus, it ignites. I had a chemical professor back in university that was
When you say ignition, what do you mean? Like, does it ignite straight away? Is it an explosive sort of thing? Or
It ignites straight away. It can be mildly explosive, but basically the way that the chemicals react with the oxygen just causes a spontaneous flame to develop. Okay. And it's a flame that is fairly difficult to douse. And I know this because one of my chemistry professors, while trying to show us, you know, this is white phosphorus, was attempting to cut off a small piece of his big chunk of white phosphorus to show us. He accidentally ended up igniting the entire block of white phosphorus.
Really?
Yeah, in the middle of the lab. Wow. It was not fantastic. Now, white phosphorus is difficult to make in nature. Not super great, but iron sulfide is definitely something that the Dragons could make. So this is a compound that they could get using natural resources. It's something that they could get via the animals that they're eating and potentially from the surrounding rocks and other minerals that make up Westeros. Now, they can't have...
Well, on that, I don't think dragons came from Westeros. I don't think they're native to Westeros at all.
I know, and I've heard this discussion before, so that's fine. But I mean, anywhere is going to have large concentrations of iron. It's a really common element. It makes up the material, the hemoglobin associated with our blood. You'll get lots of it. So I'm not that worried about this.
Cool.
So theoretically, you can make iron sulfide in the body, but you got to be really careful not to expose it to oxygen. So this is where I think the secondary mechanism comes. So as discussed, pyrophoric chemicals in a lab setting are normally stored in an inert oil that stops them from reacting or burning. And we know that animals can generate various forms of flammable oils in nature. We've discussed the fulmar previously, a bird that can make up an oily base using the contents in its stomach. Mm-hmm. So the idea that I am proposing is that the dragons have a separate gland that they are able to generate this type of fat, this ester, this oil combination, and they're also mixing it with very, very small combinations of iron sulfide that they're generating naturally in a gland that is in an anaerobic environment. It's not getting perfused by a lot of oxygen.
Yeah.
So as a result, the chemical is inert when it's stored in the body.
Yeah. It'd However, have to be fairly pressurized as well, right? Which would...
Not necessarily, depending on how this goes. I would imagine to a certain degree, but it's going to secrete much like other glandular tissues, like a dog anal gland or like a cobra venom, that basically you're going to have these like...
Breathing fire like a dog's butt.
Yeah. You're going to end up in a system where you're able to basically spray out the compound. Okay. So the dragons are going to have glands similar to the cobra, and they're going to have this chemical stored, and they're going to be able to spray this sort of oil combination. Now,
the same way that some humans control their saliva glands?
Sort of. Yeah, a little bit. But I mean, it's going to be more of, it's going to have to spray it away from the face. And what's going to happen is that this oil combination with small amounts of these pyrophoric chemicals is going to land either on the prey that they're aiming at, or in some cases might start to spontaneously ignite a little bit in the air. But it's going to be much more beneficial if basically they spray this material out. And then it takes a couple of seconds before the... iron sulfide mixes from the oil, gets exposed to oxygen, and spontaneously ignites, igniting the oil base that it's stored within.
And that's interesting because, like, often with some dragons, with these dragons in Game of Thrones, like, when the fire comes out of their mouth, it's coming out from the mouth, like, it's a continuous stream. But you do see some dragons, and I can't recall, but I've definitely seen it before, where, like, they'll be spitting, and the fire is, like, there's a gap between when the fire actually starts and their mouth.
Yes, and I think that's going to be...
So that's the sort of thing that's happening.
Yeah, and I don't think that they're necessarily going to have a constant fire stream, because as discussed, if they're coming through the wind and they're trying to breathe fire, the fire's going to come back. I mean, that was the big thing. Yeah. They had troubles with flamethrowers and other like fire techniques used by the military. You've got to be really careful what direction the wind is coming in, because you can put yourself into a system, even with a pressurized system, where the fire can blow back on you. Yeah. And if you're a dragon moving through the air at top speed... and you're not being careful. So I think it's much more likely that they're actually going to spray their opponents or spray their prey with this combination, and then the combination is going to spontaneously ignite. Okay. So it's going to be an external burning thing where they would stop, they basically spray their prey, and then their prey a couple seconds later would ignite into spontaneous flames.
Okay.
So not perfect compared to what we see in the Game of Thrones dragons, but the idea of trying to generate an open flame from your mouth that's a continuous thing, it's just way too dangerous. So I think that's my best system for how it's going to work. Plus, pyrophoric chemicals are just really cool, and it was a lot of fun to play with those.
Cool. Okay. What do we got next?
So the next thing that I'd like to talk sort of briefly about, and I think we've sort of talked about it a lot in other details, so I'm just going to touch on it. Flight.
Flight, yeah. This is really interesting, because I mean, I've seen a clip of George R. R. Martin. It's actually in that anthropology video I was talking about. Yeah. And we discussed this when we were looking at How to Train Your Dragon as well. Like, he was talking about how he wanted to make these things scientifically accurate. So he was pointing out these model dragons in the video and saying, these aren't my dragons. They have four legs and then two wings. Which is... That concept is ridiculous, because birds, bats... Yep. If you've got a vertebrate that has wings, that's because those wings have evolved either from arms or from fingers. And that's what you've got with these dragons, which is really cool.
And he did a great job, and I think that's fantastic. He's built them in the way that they do have their front limbs have morphed into the wings, similar to what we see in a bat or a bird.
Enormous fucking sternum.
Yep. Huge. And they fly in much more similar to a pattern that we'd see associated with like a bird or possibly a bat in terms of, yeah. I mean, it's kind of a weird combination that we see through the film. The problem, unfortunately, becomes they're way too fucking big.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
There are these huge things. The wings are not big enough. And as we've discussed before, and as the Wright brothers and many other groups found, you start to get yourself into a situation where you need bigger wings to fly, but the bigger wings you generate, the heavier the wings are, the more difficult it is to flap them, to move, to shift your weight. And you just kind of end up in a situation where flight becomes incompatible for certain super large animals. Gliding is still capable.
You think those could glide?
I don't think the wings are big enough to glide. That's the other problem. But the active flight is right out. I think our dragons would unfortunately be grounded in reality.
But I mean, that happens. I've mentioned like Hatzegopteryx before, these Quetzalcoatlus, which a lot of people are a little more familiar with. They were gliders, but they spent a lot of time on the ground, and they were still capable of, you got scavengers, those dragons would probably still be fast enough on the ground to hunt things. It's possible.
Yeah, it's definitely possible. It's just, it's active flight, this whole idea that they can just take off and fly into the air and, you know, fly back to where they need to go and hover. The way that they hover, like, above the ships before they ignite them, or the way that they hover above, like, the prey that they're fighting, or some of the speeds, like, they're coming in way too quick on the wings that they have. The stress of their weight on those wings would cause them to snap and break. They're just far too big. They're far too muscled. They're far too strong to be doing this. Now, the other sort of bit that I wanted to sort of, the last two sort of points, the first of which is just the growth rate. They get way too big, way too fast.
Yeah.
So for comparison, an elephant to get to full size takes about 15 to 20 years to grow from like small elephant all the way up. One of the fastest growing large animals that's out there is the giraffe, which takes about 4 years, which is incredible to go from small giraffe to full-size giraffe. Mm-hmm. And most whales, on average, take 10 to 13 years.
Yeah.
These dragons start off really small. I mean, the thing is, it's believable with a giraffe because giraffes are born fairly big. The size increase that they're taking place is something like a 20-fold increase in their weight and size to sort of get where they are.
Yeah.
These dragons, the size that they are undergoing a far more aggressive change in a much more limited period of time. Because it's unclear, in the books, they're supposed to be around 6 years old. In the movies, there's a big discussion, but they're somewhere between, the TV show. They're somewhere between 4 and 6 years old.
Yeah.
They get far too big, far too fast. And just the way that they eat, because there's a couple of discussions within the show as to, you know, how much are they eating, where are they getting their food from. If they're reptilian-based, which it looks like they are, they're most likely going to be experiencing periods of large consumption of various materials and then rest for breakdown and absorption, similar to what we see with, like, a snake that eats once every 2 weeks to, like, once every month. They're not going to be a species that's constantly eating all the time. It just doesn't make sense for what their underlying physiology would be.
I think these guys are going to be a lot closer to dinosaurs in terms of. Okay. I think that they're endotherms. They have to be endotherms.
They have to be, yes.
Because yeah. otherwise, when they go to the north, they just would not be able freeze. To survive.
Yeah, so if they do fall into that category, then yes, they can be eating constantly. They're going to have to eat way more than what we see.
Yeah, oh, yeah, tons more. Especially like when they're up north, we see in the last episode, Danny say they're not eating enough. If they're up in like the freezing cold, they should be just constantly eating if they want to maintain any sort of body temperature.
Yeah, you should be feeding wildlings and people on the wall to them at that point. Like
And we'll get into this next week with the amount of food that and the amount of like geographic territory they'd have to cover to sustain that diet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, so they're just way too big for what they need to be. And just as a like brief overview. Growth is a really complicated process. So for everybody out there who's like, oh, well, you know, maybe they've just got a sped up metabolism or da 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 da. You have to be really careful when you're growing to match metabolic generation and metabolism with a steady body plan. Everything has to grow at a steady rate. You've got to grow in such a way that the muscles, the bone, everything is developing equally and in the right order. You don't really want to rush that process. When you rush that process, you get cancer.
Yeah,
and nobody wants that.
Nobody wants cancer.
No, and then the sort of last big thing that I kind of wanted to talk about because I thought it was one of the most interesting parts of it was the hatching and fire. That the eggs are brought into the flames and Danny brings them in, and then from the flames we end up seeing these eggs which have theoretically been, you know, hibernating for. What is it, a decade, if not more, that when they're exposed to the flames, the dragon babies burst out. This can't happen. There are really cool, and this gives me a really good excuse to talk about pyrophoric plants, which we do see a couple of different seed plants, like the long pole pine, fantastic name, which are, their seeds are created in such a way that they're actually sealed with an outside material of resin. And the resin has to be broken down by flames to allow the trees to sprout, which is why we actually do need a certain amount of forest fires to occur in certain areas to allow for old growth forests to go through a transition and for new plants, new species to basically be brought up.
This is a huge thing in Australia. There's so many different plant species in Australia that require fire, so intense heat or smoke, for their seeds to be able to germinate. Mm-hmm. And so without that, you get a monoculture, which is, why irregular fires are healthy. But fire suppression is a bad thing. With climate change, we're getting more and more fires, which is also a bad thing.
Right, which does lead the Australian people to the situation of throwing the pine cone on the Barbie, right? That's something you guys do where you're just kind of wheeling.
It's kind of a side thing. It's now part of national law that if you have a barbecue, you're morally obliged to germinate a few of these seeds at the time. Okay. Otherwise, they throw you down in Tasmania.
I thought it was New Zealand. I thought they pushed you guys down with the kiwis.
No, we don't own New Zealand anymore, so we can't use it for that sort of stuff. It's a real shame.
So there are these plants that allow this to do, but this isn't the way that eggs work in reptiles, in birds, in any species that ends up having external, like, to start with, for everybody watching as a brief overview, eggs do take place in an internal fertilization process where the egg is fertilized internally and then laid externally, but the embryo inside is still continuing to grow. All that you've basically done is taken the activity that's normally taking place in other animals in a uterus and placed it outside and still allowing that development to occur. So there's still something growing. It does need external heat a lot of the time, which is why various animals either lay in warm environments or we get things like chickens that sit on their eggs to keep them warm.
Yeah. Well, and fascinating creature, Australian megapodes. So like... bush turkeys, brush turkeys, mallee fowls, that sort of thing, create these huge mounds of like rotting leaf matter and that sort of stuff, which keeps the temperature between like 0.2 degrees Celsius at all times. Like they're incredible. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can't just simply stop that policy. Are a dehydrated structure. They can exist in a state where they're kind of trapped between life and death, where they're in a state of dormancy. you can't produce an egg, an offspring, and just say, hey, you're going to lay completely dormant until you get warmed up and start to develop into your organism again. It's just not the way that eggs work. So unfortunately, that's not going to be a big thing.
You'd almost have to have like a dormant embryo inside the egg, and maybe like the amniotic fluids that keep the embryo fed would be activated by heat. But then if you did that, like, they wouldn't be hatching, they'd just be waking up and starting to feed when exposed to that level of heat.
Exactly. You'd be in a developmental stage, and then you'd have to be incubating the eggs for some period of time until finally the embryo developed. It would not be in a state where they emerge as pretty well-formed dragons when they come out of the egg.
Yeah.
And it happens in the course of an afternoon that Danny basically goes through that fire situation.
However, really cool ecological mechanism, though, for a couple of reasons, which we'll go into next week.
So
absolutely confers advantages, like, that system. It's just not possible.
Yeah, unfortunately, from a physiology perspective. But those were my sort of, like, main points I wanted to talk about with the dragons. I thought those were sort of my coolest areas to explore. I don't know, Sam, if you had anything else that you wanted to add in or toss on for that physiological gambit.
No, I love the physiology of these dragons. We'll do our top five dragons next week, but these guys are definitely up there for me. Just aesthetically, these and, I mean, they're the best dragons in terms of, like, the CGI quality on these is fantastic. Oh,
it's great. And then when they're approaching and, like, the mouth is open and we can see the teeth, that some of which are jagged or misplaced, and they're not even. I think that's my favorite thing, is whenever, like, it's not this completely symmetrical look. There's some of the spikes that are out in various ways, and just the scales, the body, the muscle contractions.
I don't know what it is, but I really love that sternum. It's so great. Good. Yeah.
But I was rewatching where Jaime Lannister has shot the one dragon, and Dany is down.
Bran, isn't it? Bran or Bryn?
Oh, right, Bran shoots it.
She's there. Yeah, Bran wouldn't fucking shoot it.
No, he wouldn't. Bron shoots it.
Bron.
Yeah. And Jaime is running with his spear to try and either get Dany or get the dragon. As she's attempting to pull the bit out of it, and the scales are moving, they've got great definition on the blood. She's pulling the spear through, and it's just, and then the dragon turns to sort of see him before it bellows fire. Yes. So good.
That was only one of them. She has two more. If she decides to use them, to really use them,
you're fucked.
What do you mean, we're fucked?
No, I do not. Dragons are where our partnership ends.
Anyway, okay, so yeah, that covers it nicely. Well done, Dave. You got a PSA for us this week?
In terms of, like, the PSA that I wanted to get into, because I think that it's an important one to sort of discuss, which is the idea of medications, because we do see this a lot. You're going to read a lot online about different recommendations of, like, oh, you can give this compound or this chemical. You've got this lying around in your kitchen, so you can potentially reach for this to give it to your animal. Be really fucking careful. There's a lot of information out there. We've been stumbling onto some various boards where people have been recommending dosages and medications that you really should not be reaching for in those types of situations.
I've seen this before from a couple of your mates, I think, posting this sort of thing online. Like, hey, do not give, like, Panadol or whatever to your dog. Like, it's...
Yeah, and people come in all the time, and it's also because they don't necessarily consider the combinations. So there's a type of group of medications called NSAIDs, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. They're like ibuprofen in you or I. And one of the ones that we employ a lot in veterinary medicine is Medicam. And it's not without its risks. It can develop GI ulcers, and it can be really hard on the kidneys. And there can be major problems associated with it. And we do see people that have an animal that's already on Medicam, and they're like, oh, it's really painful. I was reading online that I can also give my dog ibuprofen, or I can give it another NSAID to help with the pain, but they're not considering the fact it's already on an NSAID. Or it's on a steroid, and they end up giving it an NSAID, which is a really bad idea.
Okay.
I understand that, like, it's hard in these situations that you're trying to get your animal taken care of. There's nothing wrong with calling a veterinary clinic and just saying, like, hey, can I give this? Or would this be a good combination? And usually you're going to get a vet that'll get on the phone and say, hey, I recommend you coming in for an exam because otherwise I'm trying to figure this out from a distance. Yeah. But here are my recommendations based on this type of medication and what are the risks associated with giving it. Because otherwise it can create some serious downstream problems for people that have various side effects and outcomes for where things sort of end up.
Okay, cool. All right, well, look, I think that just about wraps us up this week, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, so. Also, hang on, just based on that PSA, are there any pet medications that you would not recommend humans take?
Pet medications that humans probably should not take. Don't take your pet's tramadol. We see this a lot. It falls into
really?
The opioid category. Yes, people.
Oh, shit.
We are starting to see it's much worse in the States, but it's happening in Canada, of people trying to get opioids and various products for their pets. We don't have a lot of great ones that we give you just because we want to make sure that you're not giving opioids to your pets or to yourself. Tramadol is not a good trip from what I have heard. And the other thing just being, I've had a number of people come in that are really worried that if we give their pet an opioid in clinic, something like hydromorphone to help with the pain, that their animal is going to become addicted and become part of the opioid crisis. drug-seeking behavior is easy for humans because we know that there's a drug out there and we want to seek it again. On the other hand, animals don't really have the ability to go, I really loved that, I'm going to hurt myself so I can go back to the veterinary clinic and get some more hydromorphone.
Okay.
And with the exception of, I have seen one little dog repeatedly because it keeps getting into its owner's cocaine over and over again. Most of the time...
is this that guy who you had to be like, hey, it's your dog's been doing cocaine? No, it hasn't. Yeah. It has. Okay, but it's not my cocaine. Is that okay?
Yeah. You can cut that part that you're discussing out.
Okay, fine. Yeah.
But just because I don't need that turning into a situation, I can say that we do have a dog that keeps getting into cocaine. But yes, it's that dog.
Fair enough. Okay.
But yes, besides those types of situations, pets generally are not going to seek out drugs on a regular basis.
Okay. Good to know. All right, well, in that case, thanks for listening again this week. Thanks again to my friend and colleague, André Gruner-Ofstad, for helping me flesh out some of the ideas for the ecology that we'll be discussing next week. But in the meantime, if you want to get in touch, we are cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can find us all our breakdowns online at cinematicaanimalia.com. If you want to read some of the more hardcore ecology stuff... Hardcore... More purely scientific ecology stuff that Adam and I do. We're at ecologyforthemasses.com. I'm at Twitter on Sam Perrin, NTNU. You can find Adam at Harsic Adam. And you can also contact the show at C_Animalia on Twitter as well. So, for the third time this year, we haven't done an episode with the three of us all together in the same chat room for quite a while, have we?
No,
anyway,
not for a bit.
The monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye.